Accession number 28361, Reel 20.
General Julian Thompson, Reel 20. You're saying that after you'd got the program rejigged back to its original style, things went on in a fairly smooth way. Do you think that this reduction in the time had a deleterious effect on the level of skill and training?
I don't think it necessarily did. It threw more responsibility onto commanders when the chaps arrived. To fill in the holes,
bring them on,
mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. Which they hadn't had to do before. Wow. So, I don't think it was a good idea cutting the training from 18 months to a year, but it just had to happen, and we had to get on with it. Really,
what about the character and quality of the officer candidates who are coming through to Limpson at that time? Were they the same as had been the case in your day?
Yes, I think if anything, they were better.
They were better.
Because they, some of them seemed to, many of them were more mature. A lot of them hadn't come straight from school, as I had, and my contemporaries had. A lot of them had done other things and been out, and you know, the sort of whole idea of taking a year off was beginning to catch on.
The gap year.
I didn't think it was called that then, but and also we were beginning to get, towards the end of my term, our first graduates, because we started taking graduates then.
Was that a matter of deliberate policy?
It was deliberate policy, yes. It wasn't sort of, you know, force majeure, it was deliberate policy.
How did you go about attracting graduates? What measures were taken to draw them in?
I think it was the way that we did it was they got paid a bit more, and their promotion was accelerated. Those are the two things that we did to attract them.
That can cause resentment amongst non-graduates, can't it?
Yes, it can.
It can be a source of a fracture.
It can indeed. And I don't think it happens now. Mm. In fact, it doesn't have to happen because the majority are graduates anyway, so the others are in the minority. Mm. But for a bit, it did cause a bit of faction. Mm. I mean, I can remember a headmaster. We got together a bunch of, over a period of time, headmasters from schools while we were thinking of producing. Well, we knew we wanted graduates, but we were then trying to sort of sow the seed in the heads of headmasters, because the army, of course, was doing it.
Yes.
And they sort of said, why do you need graduates? Well, I thought it was a pretty funny question coming from a headmaster. I thought it would be pretty obvious why you need a graduate. And we said, you know, if we don't start attracting graduates, there's a whole slice of the market we're not going to be able to tap. And of course, we were very much also doing the in-service degree. That was very much happening as well.
That's rather expensive, isn't it?
That's rather expensive, but it was a way of catching up, and it was a way of attracting people who wanted to go to university and would not necessarily have joined us if the idea of going to university, you know, was going to be completely ditched. If they were going to have to give up the notion of going to university by joining the Royal Marines, and they might have joined the army instead.
Of course, by this stage, you've got way beyond national service.
Way beyond, yes, yes. National service has been over for, well, the period I'm talking about is now 1969. National service had ended 9 years before.
Had that had an impact on the officer corps?
No. By the time national service ended, we were actually commissioning very few national service officers.
They tailed off gradually.
Well, there were still people being commissioned, but we weren't taking them. They were having to join army regiments. So they were going to Eton Hall, and the majority of Royal Marines, national servicemen who got commissioned, didn't come back to the Royal Marines. Because we had, I think, anticipated this tailing off and begun recruiting more regulars to fill the plug the gap that had been caused by the loss of national servicemen.
So they did their 1 year, then they go off.
Yeah.
What about their physical condition? Were they up to scratch that way?
Well, when they joined us?
Yes.
Yes, I think they were. I don't remember there being any great problems with the physical condition of the chaps when they were joining, and they still went through a pretty rigorous physical preparation, as we had done, once they joined. And we still believed in, and I think still do, from what I know of the Royal Marines, this business of preparing people physically, because it pays off.
But otherwise you get an undue rate of wastage.
That's right, you get a huge rate of injury and wastage. Mm. In fact, the injury business that we discussed earlier today was just beginning to start rearing its head.
Yes.
Largely, I think, because of greater medical knowledge. And we had all sorts of... I mean, I remember hairline fractures and shin splints and contramalacia patella were the words that were being bandied about at the time. And it was at that stage that the Royal Marines introduced remedial training in the Commando Training Centre.
Mm. What did that consist of?
Well, what that consisted of was when a chap had broken his leg, say, and came back, he then went to a remedial training troop, which was supervised by PTIs who'd done... I can't remember what the name of the course was, but it was a special course that they went on. I can't tell you where it was because I can't remember. On remedial teeth, quite a long course in physiology and the whole sort of make body. And each person going to training had their own program of exercises to bring them up to speed. You did that sort of exercise. Mm. Wrist. You did other things. Mm. And now it's become quite a sort of sophisticated remedial training.
The Army has instructors who are called remedial gymnasts.
That's right, the same chap, remedial gymnasts.
They do a 2-year course at the Queen Elizabeth Hospital.
Right,
at Woolwich.
These are the same people.
Probably the same thing.
Same thing, same thing, yeah.
Another thing that has happened in the Army is that they've decided that instead of presenting physical demands as a sort of shock, they will build up to it by steps.
Yes.
They will stage the physical training so that
I think
from a low level, you can get to the required level by the time you've...
Well, I think the Royal Marines do the same.
They do the same thing.
They have exactly the same problem of people who are totally and physically incapable and have to be brought up from nothing. and this was just beginning to show its head in 1969, and there was a lot of sort of hand wringing going on. I remember about the high rate of dropout of training, the 30%. And I can remember sort of being given pep talks by Royal Marine generals saying, "We can't go on with this, we've got to reduce it, and someone's got to think of a way of doing it." Well, I can tell you in 2003, the dropout rate's still 30%.
Well, it is very difficult if you're starting.
Very difficult. Mm. But to answer your specific question, I think the officers we were getting were pretty fit on the whole, and the dropout rate was quite low.
Well, it's difficult to conceive anyone who's not interested in physically active life wanting to join the Royal Marines.
No, nor can I. No.
How long were you in that job then as chief instructor?
I was pulled out of it early.
I
should have stayed in it for a couple of years.
Yes.
But what happened was that there was a demand to replace a chap on the Chiefs of Staff Secretariat in the MOD. There'd always been a Royal Marine on the Chiefs of Staff Secretariat, which in those days consisted of 7 lieutenant colonel equivalents, because Royal Marine majors ranked as being lieutenant colonels, you know, when we had this rank anomaly, you probably know, and boy, was it a problem. But anyway, so I then went to, again, only the Royal Marines could do this. I went to a G1 equivalent job in the MOD, followed 2 years later by going to a G2 equivalent job as BM of the Commando Brigade. But anyway, I then got what in the Royal Marine slang is called a pierhead jump. A short notice move to go to London to the MOD to be a assistant secretary to the Chiefs of Staff, of which there were 7 of us. And in those days, it's important to remember, the Chief of the Defence Staff was only primus inter pares. He was not the overall boss as he is now, with a huge central staff which marches to his command, so that the single service commanders are more or less sort of just heads of their service, and dare I say it, almost figureheads now. Then all decisions had to be taken by the chiefs of staff as a body in committee or out of committee, but they had to be joint decisions, and the CDS was not allowed to say, this is what we're going to do, chaps, without clearing it with his three colleagues. So that meant that the secretary was very important, the secretariat, because we were the engine of the decision-making process.
The CDS then was effectively a chairman, wasn't he?
He was a chairman. Yes, he was. And the CDS at that stage was Elworthy, Marshal of the Royal Air Force. Marshal of the Royal Air Force, Sir Charles Elworthy.
Who were the chiefs of staff?
The chiefs of staff were... to begin with, the Admiral was a chap who'd been in the Middle East. And I can't remember his name, but he couldn't take the job up because he got cancer. He was going to be the next CDS.
Yes.
His name will come back to me. I can't remember at the moment. The Chief of the Air Staff, I think, was Grandy, Air Chief Marshal John Grandy. And the Chief of the General Staff was... can't remember. I remember the Vice Chief was Sir Basil Lugster. No, he wasn't. I can't remember the names of the other chiefs.
And as part of the Secretariat, what were your normal day-to-day activities?
Well, the way that we were divided up, well, the secretary worked, there was a secretary who was one star.
Who was that?
And he was a sailor I think he was called Bainbridge, or Baines. Bain. He was a one-star Commodore. Then there was a full colonel equivalent, and in this case it was a group captain, who was the deputy secretary, DepSecOz, and then there were seven assistant secretaries.
Yes.
And we divided the work up by geography. So I looked after the Middle East. And sitting opposite me in the same office was a wing commander who looked after the Far East. And that was designed so that when we went on leave or away, we could look after each other's patch.
Yes.
So our patches, geographically speaking, were contiguous and tended to,
So you could have a double desk.
We had we sat literally opposite each other. And the way that it worked was that all business by the assistant secretary, in the chief of staff secretary, it was done by signal. We never wrote letters. It was all done by signal, because the people we were talking to, in the case, do we want to wait for this to finish, or would it... Everything was done by signal, because the people we were dealing with, in my case, I was dealing with Command of British Forces Gulf. There was no point in writing letters because they would take ages to get backwards and forwards, out to the Gulf or out to the Far East as it was concerned. And the sort of rule in the chief and the sort of unwritten rule in the chief of staff secretariat was that you finished the business of the day in the day.
Tomorrow was clear.
Mm. And
did that entail many late nights?
Oh yes. Mm. And then Thursday. Tuesday was chief's meeting day, and they met
regularly
every Tuesday, and sometimes they'd meet on Thursdays in deputies, vice chief session, and they would meet in the chief's room, and you were allocated an item to take. You didn't take the minutes of the whole meeting, but you took. So if an item came up which was in your area, you would go in and write the minutes.
Was that all in longhand?
You wrote the minutes out like that, in longhand, as quickly as you could.
Could you do shorthand?
Well, I couldn't personally, no. But you wrote them out, and then you rushed out, and you then spouted it out as quickly as you could to a stenographer. We had a very, very efficient team of 21 of the finest shorthand typists in the Army, Navy, and Air Force, who were on three watches of seven, 24 hours about. So there was always a girl ready to take your minutes. You then spouted it out to the best of your ability to her, and then you laid it on the desk of SecOz, who then saw you in the order in which you'd laid your minute on his desk. And SecOz, the first SecOz, would used to go to the Rag and have dinner, and then you started going through your prep after dinner, and you'd open a bottle of whiskey, take the top off and throw it in the waste paper basket, stick it on the table, and then you went through his office, where he and Depsekos, who stayed for the whole of the meeting, and both taking notes, went through your minute. You had three copies, one each, literally line by line, word by word, deciding what would be actually said.
Could what had been said be changed ex post facto?
Oh yes, I'll give you a very good example. I was taking a minute, and it was to do with something to do in the Gulf, and the chief of the defence staff suddenly turned to the chief of the naval staff, who was then a very outspoken, rude officer, whose name again I forget, but it'll come back to me in a minute. A double-barreled name, and said, "What was the name of that frigate that fired a shot across the?" And he said, "What was the name of that?" It was a minesweeper actually that fired across the bows of that Iranian frigate in the Gulf by mistake. And Hill Norton's name was the chief of the naval staff. He said, "Oh, some balls-aching little boat. I can't remember its name." Well, I certainly didn't write that in a minute. I went straight along to my chums in the naval staff afterwards. Said, "What was the name of that minesweeper?" So what I actually put in the minutes, and if you go to the PRO, will be in there now, is in answer to a question, Admiral Sir Peter Hill Norton said that HMS Folkestone had fired a round across the Iranian frigate Shah of Persia. That wasn't what he said. And that's a very good example of how we would alter the minutes to reflect in accordance with a poem that hung on the wall of Sekos's office, which had been written by the first secretary to the chief of staff, Hankey.
Sir Morris,
and it went something like this: "And so when the great men repair to their dinner, the secretary stays getting thinner and thinner, racking his brains to record and report what the great men thought they ought to have thought." So it was very much that, and you then took your minute down to the clerks, where it was gone through by the chief clerk with you. And that was then known as putting it to bed. It was then typed up and was on the chief's desk by 8 o'clock the next morning. The rule was, the inflexible rule was, however late you had to stay up, and sometimes we'd be up till 5 in the morning, that minute was on the chief's desk at 8 the next morning.
What time did you have to be at work in the morning?
9 o'clock. And if you were late, you stayed in London. And so Chief's minute-taking days were quite busy, because you went, the first thing you did was you went to the Chief of the Defence Staff's briefing, CDS's briefing. Every chief had a briefing before, you couldn't go to all four, so the best thing was to go to one, CDS's. Mm. Unless there was a particular minute that you thought you ought to go to the Air Staff, and we had friends, you see, you had right of access to all these things. You just said, "I want to be there." They said, "Right." So you went there and you listened to what they were being told. So that gave you an idea of what they might say at the meeting.
The general context.
Mm. And then a lot of work, of course, was done out of committee. Mm. So you didn't have a meeting about it, but a paper which was deciding, say, future policy in the Far East would be circulating round the chiefs. Mm. And it was your job to whistle it round, get their comments or their staff's comments, put all the comments together, clear it again, and then fire it to the Far East saying, "Do this." Mm. So we were sort of coordinators. Mm. We didn't actually have any original thoughts of our own. We were coordinating other people's work. Mm. And we were sort of handers outer of work. You know, we could go to any department with the authority of the chiefs and staff and say, "By lunchtime tomorrow, we want your views on that." So it was a very interesting job, as you can imagine, because you were right at the centre of things.
Were there any really important or critical developments while you were...
Oh yes, I mean, for example, I sat in on the chief's minutes when the chiefs were deciding whether or not to back the coup in Oman. Oh. I actually took the minute.
Mm. What did they decide?
That they would.
This was when the young Sultan...
Yep. Yeah.
But isn't it the case that we engineered and organised that coup?
Indeed. We brought back the commander of British Forces, Gulf, who was in Rowley Gibb, Major General, was flown back specially from his post to the UK to attend a chief's meeting with the political resident Persian Gulf, and the Foreign Office, the chief's briefing before were being briefed by their staffs, don't support it. And the Foreign Office turned them round at the meeting.
Yes. I was going to ask if you frequently had Foreign Office representation.
Yes, the Foreign Office always had the FO always had a sort of AUS, two-star level chap sitting in on the chief's meeting. I mean, the chief's meetings were the permanent members of it, were the four chiefs of staff, the secretary and the deputy secretary, the DUSP, who in those days was a chap called Pat Nairn. The previous one had been Frank Cooper.
Yeah.
And who was obviously...
This is Deputy Undersecretary.
Deputy Undersecretary of Policies and Programmes. A civil servant. Two-star grade civil servant going somewhere. I mean, they all ended up as PUSs.
Yeah.
And then there'd be a sort of his opposite number two-star guy from the Foreign Office, usually. Then there'd be the VCDS and perhaps a couple of other people brought in for the occasion.
And others by co-option, by ISO.
Others by co-option. And the other thing we did as secretaries was serve the tea, believe it or not, and the biscuits, because the Mountbatten had laid down that the discussion would not be interrupted by the serving of tea, and therefore no one could serve tea who was not allowed to be privy to the chief's discussions, and therefore you couldn't have a load of waitresses coming up from the greasy spoon doing it. I suspect it was partly grandeur on the part of Mountbatten, who felt he was not going to serve his tea by anybody less than a lieutenant colonel or equivalent. Anyway, so...
That's a bit low, really, for him.
It's
I thought Major General would have been...
Well, he certainly allowed it, and the tea was actually quite a funny little ceremony in itself, in that the tea would arrive on trolleys in the outer anteroom of the chief's meeting. And we had a way of communicating with the deputy secretary inside on a sort of pad. We wrote on this pad, and the message appeared on his pad. In
it was a magic pad.
Yeah, electronically. So we would just put a big T on the pad, and he would tick it back to say, bring it in. And by that time, we had poured it, and we trolleyed it in and laid it in front of the trees. And to begin with, the first 6 months of your time in the deputy, in the secretary, you were only allowed to do the biscuits in case your nerves, at serving this stuff to the chiefs would involve slopping the tea over into the saucer. And it was served without any interruption in the discussion.
So tea at the desk. And what time did the chiefs start their meeting usually?
About three.
So it was an afternoon meeting?
It was an afternoon meeting,
And it would then go on until...
It would then go on until it went on. I mean, it would sometimes end quite quickly, or sometimes it would go on for a couple of hours or 3 hours.
When...
happens, you went in, you stood by to do your bit, so you were out there waiting, you see, and then... The thing would say next in
Middle East,
and you dive in and you pass another chap coming out, and of course they'd have started the discussion before you arrived sometimes, and they weren't waiting for you.
Was your Foreign Office Waller actually an MI6 man?
Head of MI6 used to attend.
He did.
C used to attend most meetings.
He did.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. No, I mean, there was a sort of straight Foreign Office guy there, and C was always usually at the meetings, actually. Yeah.
When there was this plot to install Sultan Qaboos.
Yeah.
I mean, was that initiated by the Foreign Office resident in Oman, or was it an MI6?
I think it was initiated by the Foreign Office guys, and of course it was in order to get rid of the old man, because he was so reactionary that we weren't going to bloody well win the war while he was still there. That was really the basis of it.
Didn't he have a habit of taking pot shots at suspicious-looking visitors to his court?
I think he did do that, but what he wouldn't allow any modernisation. And at the stage that he was booted out, I mean, Salalah was surrounded by the baddies. I mean, they were within mortar range of the airfield. He didn't own any of the Dhofar. at that stage. Mm. I mean, the comeback only started when his son was put in his place.
Yes.
Mm. So I mean, the other thing I dealt with was the Indo-Pak War, one of the Indo-Pak Wars.
Well, there was an Indo-Pak War in 65.
65. Was there one in 71?
Yes. This was the one which saw the birth of Bangladesh.
Yeah, right. Yes.
That was started with the floods in Bangladesh.
Yeah, right.
In East
well,
Point, Bengal.
Yeah, well, I was there for that, yes. So that was quite exciting. And then the other thing we were involved in was the Brahmi Oasis row.
Yes.
Which, as you know, is claimed by three countries.
Mm,
and the one thing that was exercising the chiefs was the fact that they suddenly realised that the aeroplanes of all three countries were flown by RAF officers.
Mm.
And there could be a problem. The RAF officers all fighting each other. So,
yes.
So we in that 2 years, I had some quite busy. Mm. I mean, there was the coup, there was the Indo-Pak War, there was the Bangladesh floods, and then the war itself, and then there was the Bahrain. And we had, I mean, there was something simmering pretty nearly all the time.
Now,
and it was during that time I went out on a visit to Thailand.
Mm.
Really stepping into the shoes of my Far East chap. And I was lucky I went on the trip instead of him. I can't remember why, but I was sent on that trip.
Now, the Indo-Pak business, I mean, things were simmering in Kashmir all the time, as you can imagine, and there was trouble in East Pakistan even before the thing over the floods. But in what way were British military interests affected?
Well, the floods, of course. We actually sent a team of guys to help.
Yeah.
One of the LPDs went up from Singapore.
This was humanitarian.
Humanitarian aid, yeah. British interests, the only effect, as far as I can remember, of British interests was worry over the Gurkha lines of communication from Nepal and getting the guys to Calcutta. They then went by sea.
Yes.
Or did they go by air by then, because Singapore had closed? And they went by sea, I think, to the Gurkha, because the Gurkha depot was still, I think, at that stage in Malaya.
Mm.
So I think there was that concern. But I don't think there was any real worry about British interests being touched by that war, other than the fact that, you know, they were both members of the Commonwealth. I think
yes.
Pakistan was a member of the Commonwealth at that stage. And of course, the other thing that impinged was that the great Cento was still alive in those days, and Cento was
Pakistan was a member of Cento.
Which a member, and
remember,
Cento
yes.
because I dealt with the Middle East. Cento fell into my bailiwick.
So you were Central Asia as well as Middle East?
Yes, I overlapped with an airman who did sort of Cyprus, Near East, Jordan and all that.
Mm.
Because I had sort of Pakistan and the Gulf, therefore Iran, in my patch, Cento was in my bailiwick. And of course, Pakistan was a pretty leading member of Cento, and there was worry there. The other thing that we got involved in, of course, was the Shah was still in control, and this is 1971. We were going to withdraw from the Gulf. The Shah saw himself as king of the Gulf, the power broker. We were quite keen on the idea there should be somebody there. This is the Cold War, remember. That there should be some sort of, but we didn't want anyone too powerful who would get up the nose of the Arabs.
Indeed, I mean, this time wasn't it? The Shah was demanding the whole of the Shatt al-Arab.
That's right. He demanded.
Persian territory.
That's right. He demanded the second thing he demanded was the Musandam Peninsula, which is the bit that sticks out of Oman. And we told him to go away, but he was given the Tums and the Abu Musa, which are two islands right off the tip.
And they
sit like a cork in the mouth of the Gulf.
Mm.
And they actually belong to the Oman, and we allowed the Shah to take them. There's another meeting, was quite interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, I was also involved at the Whitehall end of the Dhofar War itself, and saw the setting up of the SAS Firkah. I remember Johnny Watts coming to